The big what if.
One of the major ways in which both fantasy and science fiction are kind of important or essential in what they're doing is precisely in offering an alternative vision. It may not be a very happy one. It may not be an alternative you want to go to, you know, like all the dystopian novels. But all imaginative fiction sort of says, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly the way it is.
That's science fiction doyen Ursula K. Le Guin. We talked to her about her magnificent two-volume short story retrospective, The Unreal and The Real. And murder mystery maven Archer Mayer talks about his latest in the Joe Gunther detective series, Paradise City.
These things are novels about people in stress, about people undergoing problem-solving procedures. But I don't want to write them that way because they sound terribly dull. So I put in a good guy, a bad guy, and a car chase, and a dead guy.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riana. I first encountered science fiction writer Ursula K. Le Guin when I was 19, and it changed my life. The book was The Left Hand of Darkness, published in 1968. It portrays a society where gender is fluid. On the planet Gethin, people can become female or male at different times of their lives, but most of the time, they're neuter. The book blew my mind, maybe because I was just beginning to challenge the stifling definitions of femininity that had hampered me and so many other young women who grew up during the 1950s and 60s. Over the 50-some years that she's been writing speculative fiction, Ursula K. Le Guin has created vivid alternative worlds that challenge traditional notions of gender, social power, religion, sexuality, and ethnic identity. She's explored these themes also in stories that take place on Earth, albeit sometimes in imaginary countries. Now Le Guin has selected 40 from her more than 100 short stories for a new two-volume set out from Northampton, Massachusetts-based publisher Small Beer Press. The first volume is Where on Earth, which includes 18 of her satirical, political, and experimental Earthbound stories. The second, Outer Space, Inner Lands, brings together many of her most loved science fiction stories. Some are from her body of work set in the Ecumen universe, the Galactic Federation to which the planet Gethin of the Left Hand of Darkness belongs. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of numerous works of fiction and poetry, including The Wizard of Earthsea, The Left Hand of Darkness, and The Lathe of Heaven. Given that her newest collection is entitled The Unreal and The Real, I asked her if there's actually much of a difference between the two.
No, there's not. And that's one reason why I chose that title, The Unreal and The Real, and put it in kind of backwards order because we're more likely to say the real and the unreal, you know. I'm kind of challenging the reader to decide what do they mean real? A real country. How real are most countries we haven't been to us? And so on. Yeah. I don't know. It's just sort of, I'm playing games a little bit.
Well, you will play some pretty delightful games with, I think, the idea of what fiction and your fiction is. In fact, you say that in your introduction, you say we need a whole new discourse on fiction because you don't really like the categories into which fiction has been placed. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, of course, it sort of goes back to what you said, that you, like most people, think of me, if you know me at all, as a science fiction writer, or God help us, a sci-fi writer, as sort of not dealing with the grim realities of existence and so on. And if there was ever very much truth to that, and there's some, it's that truth is kind of leaching away. The genres are mixing back into the so-called mainstream, or vice versa. And we're getting more writers, well, like Michael Chabon is my favorite example, of mixing it all back in together so that the sort of domination of absolute realism it doesn't hold anymore. It doesn't hold water anymore. I think we've kind of worked through it.
And in fact, it's there have always been writers who have crossed those boundaries. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. But they kind of, you know, they were, particularly in America, they were kind of herded into the genres for many years. And then when you got writers that sort of were obviously couldn't be called sci-fi writers and sort of dismissed, not reviewed, well, let's say like Jorge Luis Borges, well, he's foreign. So he's foreign and he can get away with it and still be literature. But if you wrote fantasy or science fiction or anything like it in the United States when I started writing, you were immediately genrefied and read out. It wasn't literature. And the major reviewers would not review it. And the major prizes do not go to it. So I have to, you know, when I broke into The New Yorker, that was kind of a big step both for me and for science fiction, or whatever it is I write.
And what did you break into The New Yorker with?
I'm sorry?
What was the story?
I break in with? There are several stories in that collection that The New Yorker first published. One of them was one of the Orsinian stories, these stories that take place in my invented Central American country. Like, a lot of my fiction is simply not really very identifiable as, you know, this is science fiction or this is fantasy as we think of it now. They're kind of in between and mixed around.
Well, you can think of, like, the Terry Pratchett, is that his name? Kind of science fiction, the kind of fantasy that is just, you know, purely entertainment.
Yeah, sure.
But
there's always been stuff like that, yeah.
But your work, to me, I've thought of it as speculative fiction, even before I knew the term, because it was always asking, what if you had a society, for example, like with The Left Hand of Darkness, which was the first book I read of yours and completely knocked my socks off. What if you had a society in which people became both men and women at different times in their lives? I mean, that was such an amazing concept to wrap one's mind around. Could you talk a little bit about
that? It was fairly new in 1968, I can tell you.
Yeah, and I think that's probably when I read it, as a matter of fact. The very notion that you could have a society like that, and then it appears again in this collection as well, in two different stories in a way, some of those ideas. Your story seemed to be a lot about power and power relationships, particularly as they relate to gender, but not only.
Yeah, isn't a lot of fiction, aren't a lot of novels kind of about who has the power and how they use it?
Yeah, but not as social commentary.
Well, I'm not sure. It can be the power within a family, after all. Or, well, okay, take somebody as kind of lightweight and seemingly innocent as Trollope's. His novels about the English clergy, there are huge power struggles going on in those novels. They're on a very small scale. I think, you know, power or status, whatever you want to call it, which of course includes gender relationships, is kind of one of the major ways that novels approach relationships. I'll tell you, Francesca, the reason I kind of resist a term like speculative fiction is it sounds so intellectual. You know, you speculate in your mind. Well, sure. And that's, I love it. And I love reading books to do, and I love writing that kind of thing. But science fiction, no good fiction is written straight from the head. It's got to involve the emotions and the body. You know, speculative makes it sound like you have to kind of be intellectual to read it.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of struggle against that a bit.
Right, and I can understand it, although I would certainly never accuse your novels of not being emotionally powerful. So,
well, good.
not at all. I mean, I can say that The Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed changed my life because they opened me up in a path. And I can't even tell you much about the plot of either anymore because it's been decades since I've read them.
Plot is not my strong point, I can tell you.
But they had a powerful emotional impact on me because they opened up my vision to the idea that society could, in fact, be different than what it is. And I think that's what I found not unique in your work. There are other people who have written about that, but I think you've been one of the greatest practitioners of that, of imagining a whole new way that people could construct the way they relate to each other in society.
I suppose doing that is one of the major ways in which both fantasy and science fiction are kind of important or essential in what they're doing, is precisely in offering an alternative vision. It may not be a very happy one. It may not be an alternative you want to go to, you know, like all the dystopic novels, but all imaginative fiction sort of says, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly the way it is. And that is very important. I think one reason why imaginative fiction is very important to adolescents is they're looking for, you know, for ways out and different ways to do things. And that fiction can come along just at that right moment and sort of say, yes, it's legitimate to think that way. There might be another way to handle the relations of the sexes or whatever it is we're talking about.
And can I ask you, where did that idea come from? Just the way you constructed, maybe tell our listeners a little bit about the people in the Left Hand of Darkness. Do you mind?
No, I wrote it a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I hope I can remember. Well, they are fully human, except their whole sexuality is different in that they are, for most of the months, genderless. They are neither male nor female, and they have no sexual desires or proclivities. And then they go into heat, as it were. Once a month, they have the potentiality to be either male or female, and then it gets kind of complicated because it depends on, for instance, if they're with a person who's, it's called going into Kemmer. If the other person is in Kemmer as a male, they will almost inevitably develop as a female for a few days. And then they are very highly sexually motivated. So somebody in the book speculates that perhaps since they live on a very difficult planet with a very cold climate where life is hard, maybe this makes it a little more certain that they'll have children. You know, that they will sort of always go into heat together. And the female will always be receptive to the male. But the thing is, the way it works out is, of course, you can be both a father and a mother. And so society is somewhat different than our society. And I was, back in 1968, I was a little bit timid, actually, working out exactly how it would differ, how the society would differ. The one thing I was pretty sure of, it seems to come forth, was that they did not have war in the sense we do. They did not have large, organized aggression. They just killed each other by ones and twos.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with science fiction master Ursula K. Le Guin about the unreal and the real, the new 2-volume set of some of her best-loved short stories. And that shows up again in one of the stories here. There's a link in the story in the second volume, which is Outer Space, Inner Lands. You have the story Betrayal, and one of the characters is reading in a book about these very people. And it says, on Gethin there has never been a war. And this is a planet where there has been a slave rebellion that has overthrown the slave masters, and yet war has continued. Could you talk a little bit about this story, Betrayal?
It came from a book called 4 Ways to Forgiveness, which is a kind of a set of linked novellas. I got this sort of vision in my head of this. It's a pair of planets, one colonized the other, and it's a slave society. And just for the hell of it, I made the slaves white and the masters black, as it were, just because I like to turn things upside down that way. And I guess the reason that the whole trying to think out slavery, and I sort of think through writing fiction. My mind works best if I'm making up a story. It's how I think. I was trying to think, what is involved in slavery? What does it feel like? If you've been a slave, really a slave, and you do work free, what is that like? What is it like to own slaves, to be a slave master or mistress? So I guess a lot of my novels and stories are thought experiments. I'm trying to think things out by personifying them, making them real in a story.
Which is what I meant when I said speculative fiction. It's a whole what if. And you do it so marvelously. I mean, there's, in this story, the betrayal. I loved it. You know, you have... I don't know how much you want me to... I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot to necessarily have a spoiler about in it.
Oh, no. No, not yet.
So
there, as I say, my plots are not important.
Right. And I also wonder, you talk about some of your stories being geriatric realism. I thought of this as geriatric unrealism. because you have two old people. Who are both fleeing the world. One comes from a position of relatively little power. One was the former ruler of the planet after the slave rebellion, had been the ruler of the slave rebellion. And you find them gingerly approaching each other. It's a really lovely, lovely story. You know, I was just very affected by their relationship to each other. Could you talk a little bit about developing that line of the story?
I'm not sure how intelligently I can talk about it, because that was, like so many of my stories, the character, the point of view character, the woman, who, they, from my point of view, those people are not so very old. I think she's 60-ish and he's 65-ish, which is possibly adolescent from where I am now. But anyway... the character sort of comes into my head, and with her situation and kind of who she is, and that she's gone off to try to sort of meditate and enter the last stage of her life properly, you know, according to her religion. And she meets up with this man whom she actually hated passionately, because he was sort of a dictator who took over a revolution. And she believed in the revolution and not in the dictator, you know. So there's although they never knew each other, there's a kind of a enmity towards him in her heart. And yet she finds this, but he is a man. He's just a person. He's not a dictator anymore. And it's kind of against her will, almost. They form a relationship which grows into a somewhat troubled loving relationship. So I was just kind of following these people who, both of whom, as you say, are kind of off on the edge of things and have put themselves or been put into rather extreme loneliness. I write a lot about lonely people.
And why is that?
I don't know. They're interesting. I think introverts are much more interesting than extroverts.
Yeah.
That could be prejudice, you know.
Yeah, you say something about that in your introduction, that we live in a society that's so extrovert centric.
It is. It values extroversion. It seems to me it overvalues it a bit. There is a story in there called Solitude, which is my sort of the introvert's revenge. I imagine a woman who is deeply introverted just by nature and who achieves her kind of paradise. And that was fun to write. And, you know, when you watch everybody going by with some sort of communicating instrument clamped to their ears and mouth, you kind of wonder, doesn't anybody ever want to just walk through the streets and look and listen anymore? You know?
You see,
do we have to be talking to each other all the time?
I think you put your finger right on it, if I may digress from talking about your books for just a minute, because actually when you are alone, I find you're much more open to the world that is around you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When you go for a walk with a friend, if you start talking, you kind of lose the beach or the mountain or wherever you're walking, you know, and you go into the relationship and the conversation. But to really see, you sort of have to be quiet.
Exactly. And actually, it seems to me that writers need to be observers. Good writers, if they're going to write the kind of emotionally powerful work that you do, Ursula K. Le Guin, you have to be an observer.
Yeah. I think a lot of writers really need silence. And now that writers are supposed to all rush out and sell themselves continuously because the publishers have sort of ceased to do so, it's harder for writers to find the kind of the room of one's own that Virginia Woolf talked about.
Yes.
And, you know, when you say a room of your own, you mean a quiet room, a room where the only noise is the noise you want.
That's true. Now, there's another story in this collection, again in Volume 2. And this one also, I think, is in the Haynish cycle. It's The Matter of Segre.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking with Ursula K. Le Guin about her new collection of stories, a new book, two volumes, The Unreal and the Real. Volume 1 is Where on Earth? Volume 2 is Outer Space, Inner Lands. And in that second volume, The Matter of Segre, you said something before about how you like to turn things on their head. And this one also very much turns things on their head. It's about a society in which women have all the power, but none of the glory, and men have all the glory, but none of the power.
That is a kind of, that is a sort of classically science fictional story in its origin. It is, you know, a bit of a puzzle why there are as many men as there are women, or why there are as many female cats as there are, I mean, as many male cats as there are female cats. Because you don't need that many males to keep the females reproducing. Look at your average flock of chickens. One rooster and 20 hens, right?
Yeah.
That works fine. So why are there so many males? And it actually is not a question that has a definite answer given by science. So I just imagined a world where that, for whatever reason, that proportion didn't hold, and that males are quite rare and therefore extremely valued. And yet they're not enough of them to dominate the society the way they dominate, as far as we know, all extant Earth societies. So what would you get if you had a society where there was maybe one male child grew to adulthood? So how would, well, of course, you can think of 100 ways they might handle that. But so I just thought of one and made a rather grim set of little short stories about it.
You also deal with the issue, though, of identity, you know, gender identity versus individual identity in this story, something you take up in another story as well, although not from the gender point of view. That story is Nine Lives. I'll just quote from one of the characters in The Matter of Segre. This is after this society has been contacted by the Ecumen, is that how?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By the Ecumen, this confederation of planets. They have been contacted. They know their society is in some ways unusual. And this character says, maybe in a few more decades we'll decide we should remake ourselves. In other words, we should genetically engineer us so that we have a more equal balance between the sexes. But she says she doesn't want to be alive then. That she likes our people, our fierce, proud, beautiful men. I don't want them to become like women. I like our trustful, powerful, generous women. I don't want them to become like men. And yet I see that among you, that is the others from the Ecumen, each man has his own being and nature. Each woman has hers. This is a very interesting counterpoint between how we structure identity as an individual and as part of the group.
Good, because that's exactly what I wanted it to be. In a sense, I've tried in various ways to kind of shake up our fixed belief that there is a gender identity and that it is kind of eternal and God-given and must not be changed and so on. Since, I mean, any study of anthropology can tell you that gender is constructed rather differently in different places, even on Earth. And since gender is not constructed very well in our society in many ways, it's very hard, I think it's unnecessarily hard, both on men and on women. As a fiction writer, I enjoy just shaking up the mixture and finding what comes out.
I told Ursula K. Le Guin that one of the stories that most surprised and delighted me was about a being that seemed very much like a mouse in a laboratory.
A rather small alien being who is unfortunately has a very highly specialized diet, kind of like our koala bears do. You know, koalas can only eat eucalyptus, which in the long run is not a very good idea for the survival of the species. It's a first contact story, to use the science fictional technical term, you know, when a first contact between Earth people and some other species. And so the scientist who is studying this rather small alien treats it may resemble something a bit mouse-like, because he treats it kind of like a little rodent, puts it in a maze. And he gives it the right kind of food, but unfortunately the food is dead. The animal can live only on living food, which is also true of certain earth organisms. But of course, you know, in the larger sense, Francesca, it sort of is a mouse. I'm putting the reader into the point of view of a mouse in a scientist's laboratory.
Right. And this mouse, I mean, the maze is a whole marvelous construct that is religious and spiritual and intellectual and social for the mouse. You know, I just love to read something about it. For example, he says the second maze was a kind of simple version of the ungated affirmation, quite adequate for the reassuring, outreaching statement I wanted to make. I mean, it's just lovely to conceive of the maze as a kind of language and construct.
Yeah, now, you see, that came to me from my little space alien mouse when I began communicating through fiction with it, that these people, and they are people because this is obviously a highly intelligent creature, they communicate through dance. Their language is dance, and that is what the poor scientist who's totally verbally fixated, the language is has to be verbal, you know. He cannot see that the little alien is wildly attempting to communicate, and the Earth scientist is attempting to communicate with the alien because it sort of intuits there's some intelligence here, but I don't get it. Both of them, one dies of frustration. The other just ends up kind of brokenhearted. He never could figure out his little creature.
Yeah, he tries to deal with the creature through a kind of Skinnerian, you know, pushing the levers to get food or an electrical charge.
Let's hope when we really do meet some space aliens that we're not stuck in that kind of mechanical version of communication.
And so I'm going to come back to my first question somewhere along in the beginning, where you say we need to have a new discourse on fiction. What would that new discourse be if you were, you know, emceeing the conversation?
Well, coming from where I come from, I would like critics and teachers, academic particularly, to sort of get over modernism and the idea that the only good fiction is realistic. It never was true, and it's getting less and less true now. Realism, as we know it, is not really capable of handling some of the realities that we live in now.
What do you mean?
Well, just what I say, that I think realistic fiction, as we've conceived it, which is increasingly, at least in this country, coming down to the unhappinesses of dysfunctional suburban families, That is a very narrow approach to existence, and it's been pretty well worked over. And I think the interesting writing that's being done is way off on other margins and edges of what was considered central to fiction. This is not to denigrate the great works of 20th century fiction like The Grapes of Wrath. But then, on the other hand, look at the subject of The Grapes of Wrath. It is not suburban discontent. I think the fiction that is considered to be serious fiction now has become rather repetitive and perhaps rather unadventurous. Fiction can do anything, like poetry, you know. So let's go.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And the collection is The Unreal and the Real, and we've been speaking with Ursula K. Le Guin. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Ursula K. Le Guin is the winner of numerous awards, including the National Book Award and the Hugo and Nebula Awards for science fiction. She's published 21 novels, 11 volumes of short stories, 4 collections of essays, 12 books for children, and 6 volumes of poetry. You can find excerpts from her work by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, mystery writer Archer Mayer talks about his newest in the Joe Gunther series, Paradise City. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Archer Mayer is a phenomenon. He's the prolific author of the Joe Gunther detective series set in Brattleboro, Vermont. 23 are published, and another is on the way. He also holds down 2 other demanding jobs that help bring verisimilitude to his writing. He's a death investigator for Vermont's Office of the Chief Medical Examiner and a detective for the Windham County Sheriff's Office. He's also a volunteer firefighter and EMT. The Chicago Tribune describes his series as, quote, the best police procedurals being written in America. The protagonist of the series, Joe Gunther, is a regular guy with a passion for justice who takes on cases that explore tough issues. The latest book, Paradise City, explores human trafficking and takes it to an unusual location, Northampton, Massachusetts, a.k.a. Paradise City, a pleasant community of progressives, students and academics, craft boutiques and great restaurants set in the bucolic Connecticut Valley. And Paradise City is the title of Archer Mayer's latest mystery novel. Archer Mayer, welcome to Writer's Voice. This Paradise City, this is just the most enjoyable book. And this is number 23. My goodness.
I know. The trees quiver when I go into the woods nowadays.
And you told me just before we started taping that you've actually started on 24. Is this a Joe Gunther police procedural as well?
It is. It's number 24, and right now I'm calling it If One of Them is Dead.
It sounds mysterious.
Yes. Well, it comes from the phrase, two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. I'm trying it out, and I like it.
Now, Paradise City, that's a title that I knew immediately what it was about, although many, people listening to the show would not. Tell us, what is the Paradise City? Why did you call it that?
Because Paradise City is actually one of the nicknames of Northampton, Massachusetts, and that is the primary locale that I use for Book 23. And it was given to the town of Northampton in the late 1800s by a visiting operatist, a soprano singer of operas, very popular back in the 1800s. These women would tour around, Jenny Lind. So she came to Northampton, and everyone turned out for her because this was a very popular form of music, unlike now. And she said, that she would forever remember Northampton as the paradise of cities because of the reception they gave her, and thus the nickname was born. And you know, there just until recently there was a Paradise City cafe or restaurant, and the Paradise City actually pops up here and there in copy shops or business names or other same places in and around Northampton. So they really sort of hung on to the name, you know, long after her passing through town.
For those of our listeners who have perhaps not read one of the books, the Joe Gunther detective series, tell us about Joe Gunther. I mean, one of the things that I really love about your writing is the psychological portraits that you paint. And Joe Gunther is not a cardboard hero. He's a complex man. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Joe Gunther was born from my notion of having a hero who embodies aspects of all of us, perhaps the best of all of us, which includes our ability to make mistakes and to atone for our errors. I have made Joe Gunther into, I hope, a bit of an everyman. I didn't want an extremist, recovering alcoholic, three times divorced, double amputee, PTSD survivor, et cetera, et cetera. For a while, it was very popular for all of these fictional heroes to be walking wounded in a way, that they were good despite their injuries, that they were tarnished and fractured knights in shining armor or dulled armor. And I wanted none of that. I thought, to be honest, that it would be interesting, A, to write police procedurals based on what cops really do, and B, to populate those books with people who were sort of familiar to all of us. Joe Gunther would be, and in fact he was named Joe Gunther because the name, funnily enough, is boring and bland. It's not Remington Steele, a popular name at the time I came up with this series of books, but it's a name that can be found in every phone book in America. And that was important to me because it seems to me that the misbehaviors of our species, which are illustrated in each one of these novels, should be uncovered and pursued and set right by someone kind of like us. And that's Joe Gunther. He's a man to whom perhaps we should aspire every morning when we wake up. But he's probably a little better than most of us can do. I have to admit that when I wake up in the morning, I could do a lot worse than to conduct myself like Joe Gunther does every day. But I'm not going to succeed, chances are, because he really is a fundamentally through and through decent guy. And most of us, while decent enough, well, we step on our heels sometimes, and so it could be minor. You just burst out at someone in the middle of traffic, or maybe you didn't say quite as nice a thing as you could have done to something, or you weren't quite as supportive to your coworker. Joe is actually quite thoughtful that way, and I wanted to make that an aspect of his heroism, the fact that, hey, you don't need to jump through hoops. You just have to be a really good fellow human being. And that might be heroic enough. So to heck with Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, I'm placing my bets on the Joe Gunthers of the world because I think there are far many more Joe Gunthers out there than there are Bruce Willis's.
And he's not just a decent guy, but he's got a heart that can be broken.
Yes, and that's the beauty. You know, one of the things that I set out to do from the get-go was that in every single book, he would make a mistake. And it was a fundamental mistake, and he would have to atone for that. It would enhance his humanness. And yes, his heart would get broken, and it has been for several times. In fact, in many ways, he's quite a sad guy. It kind of reminds me of the Kurt Wallander character, who's become very well known out of Sweden, and about whom a mystery series has now been created with Branagh being the actor playing him. I like the fact that some of us have been hurt, and some of us come out of that hurt improved and more wizened and a little sager than we were before.
and some of us come out a little bit more damaged, but still basically decent people. One of them is Willie Kunkel, who I found to be, you know, quite a sensitive portrait. Tell us who he is, because he also appears in a number of these.
Willie Kunkel is an exemplar of certainly what I am more like on my day-to-day behavior. My daughter, who's a very sharp-eyed 30-year-old at this point, once asked me, "So, Dad, does people still ask you if you're the real Joe Gunther?" And I said, "Oh, it comes up every once in a while when I'm at a library meeting or something." And she sighed, as only, you know, young women can sigh, and said, "Am I the only one who knows you're truly Willie Kunkel?" Well, Willie Kunkel is an interesting guy because he is utterly, totally devoted to doing the right thing. The man's integrity is flawless, but his character is a mess. And he is allowed to be so, I think, in part because of the presence of Joe Gunther. Gunther is an avuncular central character, a guy, a sort of go-to guy, to whom people with serious problems can go and seek some advice or just simply watch, act, and improve themselves by so doing. Willie Kunkel has had a tough life. He was, you know, in war. He was beaten up. He's a recovering alcoholic. He was not a nice guy, and he came out of his experiences far less gentle and thoughtful than Joe did, for example, who was also a war veteran. But Kunkel, thank God, has associated himself with Gunther. And Gunther has this sort of avuncular, older father ability of knowing exactly how to manage Willie Kunkel. And it allows Willie to be the very best at what he does well. And Joe does save his bacon every once in a while, as we should for our fellow human beings when we regard them highly, as Joe regards Willie. So it's an interesting dance that they have to go through, they and the other characters of the book, because occasionally they misbehave. They go too far. They get too enthusiastic in their righteous indignation. And Joe has to be around to sort of say, "Guys, that was a little bit too far." So I write as much about human development and personal interactions and all this stuff as I do about the actual murder mysteries. These things are novels about people in stress, about people undergoing problem-solving procedures. But I don't want to write them that way because they sound terribly dull. So I put in a good guy, a bad guy, and a car chase, and a dead guy.
We're talking with Archer Mayer about his newest mystery novel in the Joe Gunther series, Paradise City. Well, I was just about, in fact, to ask you, why did you choose this genre, the mystery genre, to write in? I mean, you've been dedicating your life to this now for a long time.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, it's absolutely true. I've been doing this now for over 30 years. And when I started it, I don't even read murder mysteries all that much. I've read a few, and certainly I used to read them when I was younger, but I don't read them much anymore, mostly because of my day jobs. But it's true that why would I go down this road? And I asked myself that quite seriously, because I just write mainstream novels. And then I became aware of the fact that every single day when I opened up the newspaper, there was the police blotter, there was the front page talking about some mishap involving one human being doing something nasty or stupid to another human being. And at the end of the day, on the news, you hear about the same stuff. And so the cycle continues day after day, week after week. It never stops. And I began to realize that murder mysteries actually are not escape literature. Murder books parallel our real life. And the reason I think they're so popular is that because they parallel the life, they are familiar to us, but they have happy endings. The good guys win and the bad guys go to jail. And that gives us a sort of a sense of balance with the chaos, which is in fact day-to-day life, which is far more ambiguous. We don't actually know, I'm a cop as well, and I certainly don't know sometimes why I'm doing what I'm doing, because it's never going to end. Well, that's a tough thing to realize, I think, and I think we all share the realization. So we get maybe a little bit disappointed with our fellow human beings, and therefore we read murder mysteries? That sounds like such a paradox. But not if you see it the way I just described it. If, in fact, they end up as happy stories, so then maybe you're thinking to yourself, oh, okay, maybe this is okay. Maybe the good guys do win more often than the bad guys, and here's the proof. Here is this line of fiction. So I think I ended up turning the corner, even though I don't read these books much, by writing them, because I saw them as being kind of like morality tales in a way. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason that just because they're crime books, they can't be well written. So I do spend a lot of time trying to write the best books I can possibly write. Novels that happen to be murder mysteries, because I don't see that one can't be the other.
And in fact, they can be cathartic that way, but also give you an opportunity to explore some social issues, which you do in this book. You explore the issue of human trafficking without giving us any spoilers, of course, because we don't want to do that to our audience. Give us a little summary of what the book's about.
Well, that's always tough to do because the books tend to be a little convoluted. I have a very crooked brain, as you've already suffered through some of my answers. In a nutshell, I decided to write a geographical book that takes place in three spots, primarily Northampton, but to the right of it would be Boston, and to the north of it would be Vermont, because these are Vermont-based stories. So, obviously, in my mind, I had to have some activity that was coming out of Vermont and going to Boston, coming out of Boston and going to Vermont, and both directions were going through Northampton. Well, Northampton is a very artistic town. So I began to think, okay, well, what role can Northampton play being a midpoint between Boston and Vermont? Well, art. In specific, because one of my sisters is a jeweler, I thought jewelry. Okay, a lot of jewelry is created in all these various spots, and of course a marketplace for jewelry is Boston. So I began to conjure up an idea whereby some people might be stealing jewelry in Vermont and Boston and translating them into different formats. In other words, breaking them down and rebuilding them into different sorts of jewelry in Northampton. So you'd steal something in Boston, bring it to Northampton, change it, sell it in Vermont, or steal it in Vermont, change it in Northampton, and sell it in Boston. Now, that's not actually what appeared in the book, but this gives you an example of how my brain works as I set out to write a book. So that was the genesis. And by and large, there are elements of that were still residing in the book. But I began to think, well, okay, so what workforce am I going to employ in Northampton in order to do this kind of work? Well, Northampton is very close to the Canadian border, and I had previously written a book called The Dark Route, in which I'd learned a great deal about human trafficking coming down from Canada. And that allowed me to take advantage of this earlier research and apply it to this book and suggest that the bad guys were not only running a ring of jewel thieves or heirloom thieves and breaking them down, but also running illegal aliens who happen to be artistically trained, and there are a great many of those, and taking them as indentured slaves, in effect, putting them into a warehouse and having them roll up their sleeves and working to this ill cause. So that's how that came into play. It is true that there is a lot of this, unfortunately, going on. It doesn't get much press because it's not front page news. It's all sort of under the radar. And I like to, you're quite right, occasionally, or as much as possible, go into these issues and throw a little light onto them. I think that when you write, like I write, you should do so with a certain degree of purpose. You don't want to be a dullard who stands on top of a soapbox and lectures to people. But if you can be socially relevant and perhaps useful to the overall good of humanity, in the process of writing thrilling and diverting books, then why not try?
In fact, it put me in mind of a real case that was uncovered in the Connecticut River Valley, where, you know, there are these enormous tobacco fields. I guess some of the best wrapping tobacco in the world is grown in the Connecticut River Valley, and there was a case of slavery that was uncovered about 10 or so years ago. So it happens.
Yes, it does. Indeed, it does. And in fact, a previous book I wrote talked about home invasions and whatnot in such detail that after the book came out, about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from a journalist who said, "Oh my God, a crime like this just occurred in White River Junction. You know, how did you do your research? How do you know about these things?" And I went, hang on. I'm writing murder mysteries here. Don't call, call the sources I call. Don't call me. So it is funny how sometimes people do call me up. I'd say, four or five times I've gotten phone calls from either police officers or journalists saying, "I got a case just like the one you described in your book." So it is funnily proximate.
Yeah, I was amazed at, I mean, what do I know from police procedures, but it just really, there's so much verisimilitude in this book, Paradise City, and we're talking with the author, Archer Mayer, and I want to tell our listeners, by the way, it's a great read. Do you ever get tired of your character? And if not, how do you keep it alive for you?
Well, I don't, and I don't get tired of my various characters because of what I was saying earlier about their representing the people all around me, not in real three-dimensional form. I don't know a Joe Gunther, and I don't know a Willie Kunkel, but I know aspects of so many people that are shared by these characters, and I think people come. That's why people approach me all the time and say, "Oh, I know exactly who you're talking about," or, "Oh, I work with Joe Gunther or Willie Kunkel." Poor them. I try to reflect as much of the real world as I possibly can in these books, and that includes the characters. And thus, if I were to say that I was tired of writing about Joe and Willie and Gail and Sammy and all the other guys that I regularly put in the books, I'd have to say I was tired of the people in my life, the people I work with, the people I live with. That would be a sad state of affairs, and I'm, by and large, not a sad person. And I want to reflect happily about what's going on around me. And Joe and the others, since they're based on the real stuff of life, it seems to me a bottomless creative pit. In addition, these books keep coming because I delight in going to places like Northampton and discovering what that place geographically has to offer. And I'll give you a little example. Right outside of Northampton, bordering it, is the town of Amherst. And Amherst was once host in the late 50s to a very little-known secret. It was the backup command facility for the Strategic Air Command. So if you're fond of Jimmy Stewart movies and seeing B-52s flying over the great red menace that was considered Russia in those days, and you saw that huge room that was filled with gigantic screens that showed maps of the Soviet Union and Europe, and you know, if you saw Dr. Strangelove, you saw an exaggeration of that kind of environment, you know, a dark room filled with bright screens. Well, there was such a structure in Amherst on the edge of Amherst Town, buried in a mountainside. So, you know, the great Red Menace was taken care of, and the B-52 stopped flying overhead, and the Strategic Air Command was decommissioned or turned into something else. I don't actually know the details.
It's a book depository now.
Well, isn't that funny? Exactly, this backup place with 7-foot thick concrete walls, no windows, and it's buried in a mountainside is now a library. I got to visit that place because I heard about it, and of course I put a chapter in it. So this is what keeps the books light and lively for me, and I hope intriguing for my readers, is to go, "Oh my God, I had no idea."
Now, you've mentioned that this is not your day job, although I find it astonishing that you can do a book a year and have it not be your day job. What else do you do, and how do you find the time to write these terrific detective series?
Well, I'm a little bit of a maniac, so I look at every day as being made up of 24 hours, and then I subtract about 6 hours in which I have to sleep, which I do somewhat reluctantly. So that leaves quite a few hours in any given day to work. So I think the whole concept of the 8-hour workday, for me, just simply doesn't work. It's too frustratingly constrained. So right off the bat, you can see that I've got basically the time available for almost 2 8-hour days in a single 24-hour period, just by the math. Now, that having been said, I then open myself up beyond the writing to other occupations that I would find interesting and challenging and elucidating and helpful for the writing. So the other two day jobs that I have, one is that I work as an investigator for the state's attorney's office in Brattleboro. So she's the top cop for Windham County, which is the southeast corner of Vermont. And my badge comes from the sheriff's department, so I'm a deputy sheriff on permanent assignment to the state's attorney's office. And I investigate anything from child sex crimes to murders to arsons to whatever. And my job is primarily supportive in nature. So cases come to the state's attorney and they need a little fixing up or pursuing or following up, and I do all of that. And once in a blue moon, I might actually have to initiate a case if it needs to be done or whatever. So as you can see, it's incredibly challenging and entertaining, and I never know how any day is going to go. So that's the second job on top of the writing. And the third job is that I'm a medical legal death investigator for the state's medical examiner office. And as such, I cover a county and a half in the southeast corner of the state. And I'm, at this point, I guess, nationally registered and board registered. And just because I love the academic aspects of this, so I've done a lot of special training and whatnot. And my job there is whenever anyone dies an unattended death, in other words, their doctor hasn't said, oh, my goodness, you have cancer and you have 6 months to live and they die, and that's an attended death and he'll sign your death certificate, or she will. If you fall outside that parameter, so someone just finds you next door and you died, someone needs to investigate that. Someone needs to find out why and how you died, and I'm that person. Of course, there are many of me like me across the state of Vermont, but I'm one of them.
Wow, a PI and a medical examiner, it couldn't be more perfect for the writing that you do.
It is fun. It's endlessly entertaining. I get to meet a lot of folks, most of them alive, and they tell me stories, including the dead ones. And it's so much fun to be constantly alerted to what's going on in the environment. Instead of just showing up at an office 9 to 5 and punching in and punching out, I know that there are great security aspects to that that make them quite alluring. But I've always loved to be a little wild and crazy. So I've been self-employed for 30-plus years, and I must admit I sort of like it that way. And I think most of those employers like me because I'm sort of a cheap date. I don't worry about retirement, and I don't have job security, and they don't have to worry about anything other than workman's comp.
And your readers love your books. We've been talking with Archer Mayer. His latest detective novel is Paradise City. It's a terrific read, and this has just been lovely to talk with you today.
Well, you're very kind. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
Archer Mayer. You can read an excerpt from Paradise City by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.